Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to another edition of Life Behind Bars. I'm Noah Rothbaum, the Daily Beast half full editor. Joining me, as always, is my colleague and co-host, David Wondrich.
Howdy.
How's it going?
Oh, excellent. Yourself?
Pretty good. Interesting topic this week, talking about world-famous bartenders who have essentially been forgotten. It's sort of the fleeting nature of fame. I mean, you could be some of the most famous people in the world.
In your town.
Town could be New York City or others. And where, you know, everybody knows you, stuff's being written about you in papers or you're writing stuff in papers. And then a century later, not even, you know, you could be totally forgotten.
Well, I mean, it's funny, you know, bartenders' work is measured by the drink.
Right.
You know, and as long as you're mixing drinks and more important, as long as you're talking to customers and they're hosting in your bar, you're a celebrity. But then it's hard to maintain something like that for posterity.
Right. You know, in other professions, a book might live on or, you know, a painting or something, you know, a building. But here, really, if you're the best at what you do, hopefully one of your drinks lives on. And we see that, but sometimes those drinks sort of get separated from their creators.
Well, sometimes you're famous not for your drinks. But let's talk about one guy who was famous for his drinks and who has lived on through at least one of his drinks.
Right.
And that's Duncan Nickel from the Bank Exchange in San Francisco.
That was a pretty famous bar.
The bar was built before Duncan took over. It was built in 1853. It was in the first big, heavy stone building in San Francisco. It was a building built to be fireproof and earthquake-proof.
Okay.
Because San Francisco kept burning. I mean, it was really, you know, the town was like, the gold rush was only 4 years old.
I remember from a story that you wrote, I guess earlier this year, about the origins of San Francisco, but the gold rush, you know, really remade the town from a town of literally dirt streets to one, you know, where it's paved.
They leveled the hills, most of them. They left a couple, but they did all this stuff. So they built this huge building, and there had been a bar on the corner called the Bank Exchange. So there was a Bank Exchange bar in the new building. The building was so strong that when they finally tore it down in 1963, it took them a month.
Wow.
And it was only four stories high. It survived everything, and then they turned it into a parking lot.
Oh, no.
And then they built the Transamerica Pyramid on top of it. But anyway, so the bar was open for a long time before Duncan Nickel got there. Duncan Nickel was born in 1852, just a year before the bar opened. Born in Scotland, in Glasgow, and not a rich part of Glasgow either. He was a apprenticed as a merchant seaman when he was 16 in the British Merchant Marine. He got to San Francisco, and I just found this out. I found the record. He jumped ship.
Right.
And that's like buried in like British labor records. There's you can find it online if you look really hard.
He's on one manifest, and then he's not.
And then there's a note, jump ship, you know.
During the height of the gold rush, that's where a lot of the people
I mean, Jerry Thomas jumped ship in San Francisco in 1849, and he was, you know, the most famous bartender there was.
And aren't even people, like, literally ditching their ships, right, in the harbor, and they're using some of the ships to, like, build out the city into the water, like.
Yeah, San Francisco was a crazy place. <You know? laughs> and there's still, there are a couple bars there today on the waterfront and or restaurants that are built on a foundation of old ships.
Right.
Because they just ram them into the shore and then fill the hold with rocks and just build on top of it. Another famous bartender, I think he jumped ship in 1859, was Harry Johnson, the so-called dean of American bartenders, mostly because he was the most technical writer of them. It was a thing.
And I imagine that it probably also gave these people, like, a view of the world that few people have, right? I mean, like, it's before the car, it's before the plane, it's before, you know, train travel.
Yeah, there was no other way to get around.
Right? I mean, so these are some of the few people who'd actually been to other cities, towns, countries, continents, you know, and they got to see.
Then they saw San Francisco and they were like, okay, cool. I'm done with that. Now I'm going to do this. I mean, San Francisco was a pretty wide open town.
Right, exactly.
So,
and for, it was the Wild West.
Yeah, it was. It was like, oh, you know, something could happen here.
And people were drinking really well. I mean, we've talked about this before and you've written about it before, but they weren't taking their gold and putting it in, you know, bonds.
They were putting it in bottles.
Right, they were putting it right on like the bar top and, you know, buying fancy champagne and cognac and cocktails. And
when Jerry Thomas got there in 1849, it was a dollar a drink.
Wow.
When everywhere else in the country, it was about 10 cents a drink.
Yeah.
You know, San Francisco, people would pay. Every bar had scales for the gold dust.
If you thought San Francisco was expensive today,
it was really expensive back then. Gold dust.
Google has nothing on gold dust.
So Duncan Nickel came after that, you know. 1869, he gets there. The gold rush was over. Now the new rush was silver over in Virginia City, and that was further away. San Francisco, prices had calmed down. The city was built, you know, it was being built very fast out of stone and brick and no longer like flimsy wooden houses. And he started tending bar as a bar back at this place, Alfonso Vaughn's Crystal Palace Saloon. And I bet that Crystal Palace Saloon was kind of nice. It was right there on Market Street, the main drag.
Sure.
And I don't know much about it. It's hard to find out much about this, but it seems to have been a fancy place.
Yeah.
And, you know, he starts his bar back, works his way up to the Parker House on Portsmouth Square, which is now part of Chinatown. Portsmouth Square was the old heart of San Francisco.
I imagine it looked a little bit different back then.
Yeah, I think. And this thing is on the it squats on the site of the Parker House.
Right.
For a while there, the premier bar in town.
Yeah.
It was the bar you went to get the best bartenders. Even in 1869, it was still famous. It had been famous since the 1850s.
At that time, like, San Francisco was really, you know, sort of famous for its high level of hotels and hospitality. And you see, like, even the Fairmont, I think, is built not that much after the one
that's right,
Knob
that's
Hill,
right, and the St. Francis,
right, exactly. You have this, you know, sort of rivaling New York, or you know,
yeah, it was because there was money there,
right?
You know, there was so much money because of first the gold rush, but even more came out of Virginia City in Nevada, and San Francisco was the nearest port, so everything went to San Francisco, and Virginia City was a mountain of silver that they hollowed out.
Yeah,
I mean, it was like literally the whole mountain was silver. There was the biggest, richest vein of silver.
Right.
And they just kept digging and digging and pulling it out. It wasn't gold, but there was so much of it.
Right. We'll take it.
Yeah, we'll take it. Exactly. All this money's flowing in. And the bank exchange, which, you know, had been open forever at this point, starts faltering and gets sold. 1887, after Duncan Nickel had been there for, you know, 20 years almost, he takes over with a partner and buys the bank exchange, and he saves it and revitalizes it, which is kind of funny because he's not like the most outgoing guy.
Right.
He's a Scot.
And a Glaswegian at that.
As a Glaswegian, exactly. So he's a little closed mouthed. He's a little grumpy. He's not interested. A guy gets shot at his bar soon after he takes over. And it was like right at the bar during, you know, the cocktail hour.
Right.
And he testifies that he didn't see it. He was looking the other way.
Head down.
He didn't see who did it.
Head down.
Yeah. He kept his mouth shut.
Right.
You know, he was one of those guys. The bar like really takes off because he was a good manager. And he was one of those kind of quiet bartenders who, if you're a good customer, he's your friend, you know,
right.
And he, everybody respected him for being gentlemanly, which meant he wasn't like a loud ass clown.
Right. And the drinks were good, right?
And the drinks were good, yeah.
Right.
He knew how to mix drinks.
Right.
He was very good at that. And he introduced this drink, Pisco Punch.
Right.
Since the gold rush, it had come up from South America because ships had to make made ports of call in Peru and Chile, both of them made Pisco. And they brought it up the coast and dropped it off. And this brandy, it turns out, made a nice punch. And people in San Francisco had made punch out of it before. But Duncan Nickel perfected it.
Right.
He always pre-batched the main part of it in the basement so nobody could see how he mixed it.
Okay.
And it was like pineapple syrup and Pisco together. And some people say maybe a little bit of cocaine.
Huh.
which was legal then.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, there medicinal was something. Even. People attributed extraordinary right. powers to his pisco punch. But then he'd take this and he'd mix it in front of you with fresh lemon juice and distilled water, and always mixed to order.
Right.
You know, so the base was would keep, but he always did the lemon juice and the water, the dilution to order, and made it precisely the same for everybody.
And that becomes essentially the signature of San Francisco.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, everybody is. I mean, even more so than, you know, anywhere else in the country, pisco punches. Becomes a sort of regional hit.
You know? Absolutely. And it becomes really associated with the bank exchange.
Right.
To the point where San Francisco City Hall moves away. It had been down near Montgomery Street where the bank exchange was. And then it moves to where it is now, like a mile away,
right.
a mile and a half away. And that killed a lot of the businesses around there. This guy, Louis Eppinger, had a very popular bar. Business dries up. He moves to Portland and then to Yokohama and kind of helps jumpstart American mixology in Japan. But Duncan Nichols stayed and he kept his place the same. And it becomes one of those institutions like McSorley's here in New York is famous because it never changes.
You know, it has a name or sort of signifies a neighborhood that's no longer there.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. It's like the last survivor. San Francisco earthquake and fire comes. And the bank exchange survives perfectly fine.
Because
the Montgomery block it's in was really a direct hit by an atom bomb. Could have probably cracked some windows.
Right.
But
otherwise
it was fine.
Anything up until that.
It was built by this guy, Halleck, who was a master at military fortifications. So it was pretty strong.
Not bad. Yeah.
So Duncan Nichols keeps on till Prohibition, just mixing his drinks. Closes early. He only allows two or three drinks to a customer.
He gets
really cranky and old, basically.
He's like the Kenny Shopson of...
Yeah, exactly.
Who just recently passed away, who had a famous restaurant in New York's, I guess, Greenwich Village. And he was, you know, famously cantankerous and had all these rules because he didn't want to overwhelm the kitchen. So, you know, no parties bigger than four, you know. So all these, you know, two and eight is, you know, two parties of four is still an eight, or three and a five is still an eight.
And that's not allowed.
Right,
yeah. Half your friends have to go somewhere else.
He was ready to kick anybody out at any time. You know, that always makes me think exactly. The bank exchange is the same kind of idea where if you were a regular, you could maybe get away with few things or an extra drink, or in the case of Kenny asking for no roll for your hamburger or something. But
he needed to know you.
Yeah, if you were unknown, it was very suspect to walk into that kind of place.
The bank exchange became a little bit of a tourist place too, you know, because it was famous. So people had to check off the pisco punch at the bank exchange. You know, check, I did that.
And I guess people were really drinking pisco punch until Prohibition, I guess, in San Francisco. I mean,
Harold Ross of the New Yorker was from San Francisco. Yeah. Founding editor.
Sure.
He remembered the jars of pisco being unloaded at the wharf to go to the bank exchange
because
it came in these clay jugs from Peru.
That's amazing.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
In recent years, we've seen pisco punch, you know, it's sort of a rebirth of pisco punch, especially in San Francisco. And a lot of the San Francisco bartenders, you know, embrace the drink and pisco overall.
Some of their versions are a little remote.
It's popular enough where I think, you know, people name check it all the time. It's on menus. But you very rarely hear the name Duncan Nichols, you know. And that's, you know, it's kind of funny where his legacy lives on. But the person who created it is.
And he never wrote down his recipe.
Right.
You know, that's a problem. It's recreated from people who knew him.
Right.
But nobody knows if it's the real recipe.
Right.
Other people like Henry Ramos of the Ramos Fizz fame wrote his recipe down and handed it out all over. And his bar was still packed. But Duncan Nichols thought it would mess him
up. Maybe we can get our friend Beach Bum Barry, who decoded, you know, all the tiki recipes from Trader Vic, and Don Beach, who was also secretive in his, you know, writing everything in code. And, you know, it took, I don't know, Beach Bum several years and perhaps a decoder ring from a cereal box to figure out Orgeat was A and, you know, whatever was B in Trader Vic and Don Beach's.
Well, we need to set him loose in the attics of San Francisco.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
The storage spaces and the basements and see if anything turns up. We've got a pretty good idea of what was in this. You know, it was just lemon juice, gum syrup infused with pineapple, pisco and water. Again, that cocaine angle is enticing.
I don't know enough about cocaine, to be honest, to know if it would change the flavor. Obviously, its effects would be
I don't think there was so much that you'd have one drink and bug out.
And at the time, it was in Coca-Cola, too, for a while.
Yeah, it was in Coca-Cola. Yeah, it was totally legal.
I mean, a lot of pharmacists had cocaine of some kind.
Where do coca leaves come from? Peru. I've had coca leaf infused pisco sours in San Francisco, which are delicious. It makes a very nice infusion.
It's possible too.
I mean, I'm sure it's a Peruvian thing. Coca leaf infused pisco. Maybe he was using that.
Right.
We don't know. It's amusing to think.
Yeah.
Prohibition comes anyway, and he doesn't give up his recipe. And he toodles around, gets a driver's license. He was in his 70s.
Right.
And then dies in 1926. And that was the end of him.
Well, I'm going to be in San Francisco in about a week. I'll definitely order a pisco punch and toast Duncan Nichols, as I suggest most of our listeners do next time they're there.
Absolutely.
I'll mixing one up.
He was fortunate or smart that he had a signature drink that lived on. And that kind of gave him an afterlife. Another guy I think a lot about is this guy, Jim Gray, who was the head bartender at the Fifth Avenue Hotel in New York, which was the place where politicians always stayed. It was like one of the leading bars in New York. He was super famous. Everybody went to see Jim Gray. He was born in 1855 in New York City. He was a native New Yorker, and he was behind the bar by the time he was 17 or even 15. In 1882, he was at the Astor House, which was one of the fanciest bars in New York.
And the
downtown.
World.
Yeah,
that
in
was
the world.
Super
slanky. Yeah, the Astor House was a big deal. So he had like this career, and then he ends up at the Fifth Avenue Hotel for like 20 years. He was so famous during his life. He was like Nick the Vest, the bartender at Rao's in Harlem. He always wore fancy vests,
right.
And he'd wear several different ones in a day.
Wow.
He'd go and change his vest.
Sure.
And it got to the point where his rich customers would come in with bolts of cloth for him to get vests made out of. You know, if they were traveling somewhere, they found something exotic.
It's kind of like, you know, like the 21 Club, the ceiling, you know, is a sea of all these mementos that people brought back. And I feel like similar clientele would be at the Fifth Avenue
Hotel. Exactly so.
They would, you know, I think get a lot of enjoyment out of seeing him wear the vest.
Exactly.
That they're, you know, they brought the cloth back. And I can imagine perhaps that's why he changed so often as different people came in. He wanted to wear the vest. Yeah.
I mean, it's good customer relations.
Oh, for sure.
You know, and it was exactly that crowd.
Yeah.
It was like senators, sitting presidents. Prince of Wales,
sure, of
even before Jim was there, but he stayed there. Everybody stayed at the Fifth Avenue Hotel. It was right at the corner of Fifth Avenue and 23rd Street on Madison Square, which was the fancy part of town at the time, right near Delmonico's restaurant, the fanciest restaurant. And it opened in like 1850s and lasted up until 1908, when it got torn down. Jim Gray was there, you know, from the 1880s. So he was there for like 20 years. He was famous for his old fashioned, he claimed. Although
it was different, though.
It was because, he didn't use bitters and he shook it.
Okay.
But he said, I invented the old fashioned and I do it my way.
It was usually whiskey and sugar and a little bit of ice.
And ice.
And water,
With some nutmeg grated on top. So it was kind of a toddy, really.
Right. Potent. No wonder everybody was so happy there.
Yeah. Made rum punches and just really simple drinks. So he wasn't famous as a mixologist. He was famous as a character, you know?
And I kind of feel like even though his name has been largely forgotten and he didn't leave any, you know, drinks, he sort of leaves this legacy where we see, you know, bartenders following in his footsteps. I mean, literally for decades after.
Oh, yeah.
These types of, you know, establishments serving the 1% or the people who want to be the 1%, where, you know, whether it's, you know, Norman Buckholzer, you know, at the Ritz-Carlton, who
That's
recently
right.
retired,
That's
who's
right.
famous for his Manhattans, or Doug, you know, over at Hudson Malone,
yeah.
you know, they pride themselves on knowing everybody's
yeah,
name,
exactly.
their drink order.
They're
at
not
a certain
primarily
level.
Mixologists.
Right.
You know, they mix drinks,
right.
but they're primarily like...
It's the art of hospitality.
Yeah,
too.
Exactly.
It's
they're hosts.
The drinks are good, but they're not, yeah. you know, maybe not amazing. But
yeah.
the point is that people, especially the very well-heeled and famous, mm-hmm. keep coming back because of that sort of level of...
They like personal attention.
Exactly.
they like a little bit of sucking up. Oh, that is my
well,
best.
I mean, yeah, right. that's my best. Oh, that's the drink that I ordered.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
always know that I want
yeah.
it this way,
yeah,
Jim.
Yeah, exactly. The funny thing about Jim Gray also is when the Fifth Avenue Hotel closed, he moved up the block to the greatest mixology bar in New York
right.
and killed it there, too. The Hoffman House.
Which
yeah.
is...
He was there for a couple of years. Then that closed to demonstrate that he was still a spring chicken. He mixed 35 punches in 45 minutes.
Wow.
Talking the whole time.
Right.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Well, especially the talking part.
Yeah, exactly.
He didn't put his head down. You know, and these were like individual punches.
Oh, yeah.
He knew how to mix drinks.
I can see him
yeah.
carrying on three conversations
yeah.
using like four spoons
yep,
to mix.
Exactly.
I mean, obviously there's the legendary Hoffman House, you know, cocktail book.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of famous bartenders go through there.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of clientele. And it's almost, it kind of reminds me of when the Dead Rabbit first opened. They had, you know, kind of this all-star team of bartenders.
Oh, absolutely.
Who do like, you know, Gary Regan was there.
Yeah.
And Witz and, you know, Frankie Marshall and all these other folks would come in for one night. And it's almost like the Hoffman House where he was like, okay, like I'm not like a fancy bartender, but I cater to a fancy clientele.
Yeah. And they had a fancy clientele
yeah,
at the,
exactly.
the Hoffman House. You know, all kinds of people. When he made the 35 drinks among the audience with Buffalo Bill Cody, for instance,
right.
you know, and all kinds of other rich
yeah.
people. So Jim Gray, like, killed it there, too, you
yeah.
know, and it's just really funny. But the Hoffman House also, their former head bartender, Charlie Mahoney,
yeah.
their last, like, really famous one, wasn't as much famous for mixing drinks, although he mixed
yeah.
good drinks. He was famous as a stakeholder in bets.
Right.
And if you had any big money bets,
that's where you went.
You'd give him the
yeah.
money to hold,
yeah.
you know. And he was almost dead of flu once, and he had to get in a carriage and come down from the Bronx to pay off a bet.
I mean, I think the Hoffman House is so fascinating. I mean, it's literally the grandest stage for, like, bartending
yeah.
and the sporting life. And there's, you know, a famous giant painting behind the bar that's now at Williams College at their museum.
Yeah.
You know, there are different rooms, and from the stereo optic cards I've
yeah.
seen, heavy carpets and, you know,
lots
lamps
of carved wood.
Yeah, exactly.
And
we're just like
draperies and
just
yeah.
in case you know where you were. It's like
yeah.
this place is rich. Tread lightly in our fancy carpet.
I think they had one of the first stock tickers too.
Wow.
I think this might have even been during Jim Gray's time there, is William Randolph Hearst comes in to see his father, who was a senator, and says, Father, could I have some money? And father goes, it's in my overcoat hanging over there. And he goes, you know, I won some money at the track.
Right.
Take what you need. And he pulls out $30,000.
Wow.
Just hanging in the
yeah,
overcoat.
Of course.
You know,
I mean, who's going to take it?
There's right. Also, there's more where that came
right.
from.
Unbelievable.
So, you know, the Hoffman House was full of stuff like that.
Yeah.
And the number of famous bartenders who went through there, who were trained there, like
yeah.
Frank Meyer of the Ritz
yeah.
Hotel.
Sure.
All these people went through there and
yeah.
worked at the Hoffman House.
Perhaps an episode, you know, to come just about the Hoffman House.
We could talk for hours about that.
Here's two of the many famous bartenders that, you know, sort of been forgotten, you know, over
mm-hmm.
the decades since, I guess, the golden age of cocktails. And our first episode was about Jerry Thomas, who obviously, you know, you wrote the book on. And, you know, he's become so famous that, you know, there's a Jerry Thomas project in Rome.
Yeah.
And bartenders have tattoos of Jerry Thomas. And, you know, they're all new, you know, editions of the book. And you see all of his drinks all over. And he's referenced in a lot of articles and talks. And do you think if it hadn't been for your book, do you think that we would know who Jerry Thomas was?
That's a good question. If I hadn't written that book, somebody else would have.
You think,
I think, yeah.
yeah,
because it was... He was in the air, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, where does this stuff come from?
Right.
I first got onto him meeting by chance some people from Slow Food New York, you know, part of the Italian slow food
yeah.
movement. And I said, we should do a tribute to Jerry Thomas because American bartending was a slow food art. And right. and at this point, that we were just kind of coming back to that that concept.
02, 03.
Yeah, this was 02. Yeah. And we did the tribute in 03 at the Plaza with Dale DeGroff and Robert Hess yeah. and the late, great Sasha Petrosky and yeah. Audrey Saunders and Ted Dr. Cocktail Hay
right.
and myself, Gary Regan, making drinks, and George, the bartender from the Plaza, who'd attended bar at the Black and White Ball in the 60s, wow. 30 or 40 years yeah. earlier. And we had this wonderful tribute and really called attention. And I think somebody would have written yeah. a book about him because people were already kind of working on it when I was. He was the great figure we needed, you know?
Yeah.
We needed somebody to hold up as an example.
Right.
I'm glad that I could help with that.
Yeah.
So much has been lost to history. I mean, that we keep digging and digging. There's so much rich stuff that, you know, we've forgotten, and so many amazing
stories. There's so much stuff we'll never find, yeah. you know. Some of the great African-American bartenders, yeah. The amount of information we have on them is very small.
Yeah.
You know, and I would love to see interviews with them.
Yeah.
You know, talking about how they got over in such a difficult world. Jim Gray, fortunately, got written up a lot.
Yeah.
Duncan Nickel got written up a fair amount, you know. Other bartenders who got written up a lot. But there are a lot who barely, yeah. you know. We don't know who invented the Manhattan.
Right.
We don't know who invented the goddamn martini.
Right.
You know?
Not yet. I still have hope.
We're working on it.
Hope.
We're working on it.
I still have hope.
Yeah, there's well, more sources to come.
If we do find the creator of either of drinks, will certainly include that in a future episode.
Absolutely.
To all the bartenders known and unknown, we'll raise a glass tonight.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.